easier for you to do that?
I can do it.
Okay, all right. Okay, hi, everybody. As you already know, my name is Mark Deming. Before I get going, I wanted to thank Mariah and Amber for being nice enough to invite me to speak this evening. Please give them a hand. Thank you. And I'm here to flap my gums at you about Goose Lake. The Goose Lake International Music Festival, it took place in August of 1970, and it was the biggest rock festival that ever took place in the Midwest. There are a lot of other ones that are better known, but for sheer numbers, Goose Lake was bigger than any of them. Between 250 and 300,000 people were there for the 3 days of the festival. The acts that appeared there had many of the biggest rock bands of the day played there, including Joe Cocker, Chicago, Rod Stewart of the Faces, the James Gang, Jethro Tull, Mountain, the Flying Burrito Brothers, and 10 Years After. And I think particularly relevant for people in the Midwest is like just about all the really big Michigan acts of the day were there, including the Stooges, the MC5, Bob Seger, the Up, SRC, Savage Grace, Mitch Ryder in Detroit. The line that everybody repeated was, this was Michigan's Woodstock. Also, unlike Woodstock, it didn't rain. Unlike Altamont, there were no riots or deaths. There were a few serious injuries, and actually most of the people there are actually paid to get in. So why haven't you heard much about this? Why did this event not get much play outside of the Midwest? Well, let's take a look at what we know about it. There we are. We're with Richard Songer already. Thank you. The whole story begins with a guy named Richard Songer. Richard Songer was from Southfield, and he had made a great deal of money in construction and contracting. He had did a lot of business with the state of Michigan. He did a lot of public works projects, did very, very well at it. He decided he wanted to open a park where he could feature music. As he said, it's a dream of mine to put together some place for the young people to go. So he bought about 200 acres near Goose Lake in Jackson, and in early 1969, in the spring, he staged a country music festival, which was headlined by Johnny Cash. This went fairly well, and so he decided he wanted to make the back step and throw a rock festival there. Songer's idea, unlike most places where they had rock festivals, is he wanted to have a permanent site. He wanted to have facilities that they would build there so he could have festivals two or three times a year if he wanted. That was his original idea. Now, he had the money and he had resources, but he didn't really know much about staging a rock festival. So, next slide, please. there he is. He brought in a couple of people who know such things. This guy is Russ Gibb. He was the owner and talent buyer at the Grandy Ballroom, which in the late 60s was the premier rock venue in Michigan. Pretty much all the major bands that played the ballroom circuit back in those days played at the Grandy. He was the guy to do these things. He also brought in Tom Wright. He was the stage manager at the Grandy, and he was the kind of guy who really knew about the nuts and bolts about putting on a show. He could do just about anything. Actually, for some years, he was actually led the road crew for The Who and for Joe Walsh. He knew what he was doing. So he brought in these two guys to essentially put things together. Gibb basically booked all the talent, and Wright helped design the staging. And once they were done with the park, they had come up with really, really high-class facilities for this. They were much better than you usually see with the porta-potties and the rented stage. It looks like it's about to fall over. It's like, I interviewed Wright once about this, and he said, like, by the time we were done, it looked like a state park for millionaires. Wright and Gibb had little experience with this before. In 1969, they staged the Detroit Rock and Roll Revival, which was a big concert held at the Michigan State Fairgrounds in Detroit. The headliners were Chuck Berry, Sun Ra, and the MC5. And I'm sorry, anybody who does that has tremendous vision in my book. Okay. Yeah, now this is Goose Lake Park. That's what I would like to. Now, the problem was, though, that the locals in Jackson were not terribly happy about the idea of having the rock festival there. They didn't like the idea of this much traffic, this much strain on the local facilities. They didn't like the perceived bad element. One thing to keep in mind is that the week Goose Lake happened was also the week that the Manson family trial began in California. I mean, if people were looking for a reason to not like hippies, Charles Manson kind of gave everybody one, and that certainly didn't help. You know, you're just average 19-year-old kid who had long hair and liked to smoke reefer every once in a while. As a consequence, like several of the people around Goose Lake formed the Lenawee County Residents, Lenawee County, Area Property Owners Association, and they were trying to use zoning regulations to shut down the festival before it got started. Songer could afford a bunch of lawyers, so they were bannering about this for weeks. Actually, 3 days before the festival, Jackson County Prosecutor Bruce A. Barton actually attempted to file a restraining order that would have shut the festival down. The local judges said, no, there is no merit to this. So festival ended up kicking off on Friday, August 7th, 1970. There we go. Like, by the time the show started on Friday, there were 100,000 people there, and by the end of the night, there were 200,000. More people showed up on Saturday and Sunday, which, as I said, the final tally comes in between about 250,000, 300,000, since a few people did manage to sneak in without actually using tickets. It's hard to say exactly. Another thing about the tickets, Songer and Gibb were very smart. Instead of using paper tickets that could easily be forged or passed around for people, they used actually poker chips. They were little wooden poker chips which had the Goose Lake logo stamped on them. I've never heard of anybody else using that. If you go on eBay, it's not hard to find them these days, too. You can get them fairly cheap. In order to keep things... Yes, this is the stage. In order to keep things moving, well, Tom Wright had told me that he was of the opinion that if you have that many people there, you have to keep them entertained, or otherwise, when they get bored, that's when things start to happen. So the idea is they kept everything very tightly scheduled. All the bands only played for 45 minutes each, and you cannot unfortunately see this here, but they had a really remarkable thing. They had this spinning stage. What they did was they built an enormous turntable into the stage with a wall that cut right through the middle. The idea is first band sets up in front of the wall. They're playing their set. Second band sets up on the other side of the turntable. When band A finishes, they just have like about four or five guys turn this big crank under the stage, and the whole thing just flips right around, and about 30 seconds later, the next band is up. They're ready to go. A couple of people who were there have told me that actually for a couple of the bands, the drummer has kind of got really enthusiastic about the idea. And while the thing is spinning around, they start like, kick the whole thing off. And so they're already kicking out the jams before they've even gotten into place. Actually, that's a really good question. I don't 100% knew that. I think they said a lot of it was like the drummers would tend to kick this off, but it was like they would move everything in place and then basically just, you know, plug in the leads and go from there. So I think that's how that was done. At least that's my understanding of it. Unfortunately, all the stuff I've seen about this, nobody has pictures of the stage actually moving. I've seen a bunch of home movie footage from the festival. Nobody seems to actually have a picture of that. But everybody I've talked to that was there remembers that. Generally, the people there were having a really good time. Like I said, the Faces, I talked to Ian McLaughlin from the Faces, and he told me that they had actually had such a good time that they ended up sticking around to hang out with their friends from 10 years after, who were playing on Saturday night after they'd played on Friday. Also, the people, there was a great vibe there. The people loved playing on the big stage and having some room. The Stooges, however, were the band that didn't have any fun there, which the band that wrote No Fun, why not? The big problem was Dave Alexander, the bassist. Even the Stooges managed to fall into the idea of having a hippie manager who tried to convince them to go on a macrobiotic diet. And so apparently they had all been eating like fruits and nuts for about 3 months. And Dave Alexander had also, he had sworn off drugs and alcohol during this period. Problem is then that once Dave got there and he saw the enormous audience, apparently freaked out a little bit. Friend of his hands him a pint of whiskey, and he immediately drinks all of it. Somebody else gives him a bunch of hashish. He smokes all that. By the time Dave got on stage, he was a wet washcloth. He was just... Iggy, needless to say, was not very happy about this, and he fired Dave immediately after the show, and that Goose Lake ended up being the last performance of the classic lineup of the Stooges. By most accounts, there was very little serious crime there. There were very few major injuries. The one great story about somebody getting hurt... Oh, could we move back to the lighting tower? I'm sorry. Yeah. The great story was a guy named Tom Neumeier, who had climbed up on one of those lighting towers to get a better look, and on the way up, he apparently got near fairly close to the top before he kind of lost his balance and he fell off. Remarkably, he fell there. He only suffered a couple of bruised ribs, and he was able to stay for the rest of the show. Mike Lutz from Groundsville Station, I loved what he said about it. He says, "Someone fell off a lighting tower and walked away scot-free. More power to marijuana." Now, there was also some violence that was attributed to several biker gangs that did show up for the festival. Probably the most interesting, though, bit of reported violence turned out to be a great hoax. The Jackson Citizen Patriot, during the festival every day, ran a column in which they would run down rumors that had been circulating around town about things that had happened in Goose Lake and what was the veracity of these stories. The most remarkable story was that somebody was actually reporting to the police that a band of hippies from the festival had broken onto the grounds of their farm, taken one of their cows, dragged it out into the field, and then slaughtered and ate it on the spot. It was determined this story had absolutely no basis in fact. I don't know if that is the cow, but I hope it was, because that's a lovely cow. And, then there's, the big problem, of course, was drugs, which, if you can't read it, this gentleman on his hat has a message saying, said cake batter acid, 150 per hit. Again, I have no idea where this gentleman is or what his rights are today. Please don't ask me. As you might expect, psychedelics and marijuana were wildly prevalent all through the festival. Also, in the early 70s, heroin and speed became much more available than they had been there before. There were a lot of reports that was they were circulating, and a lot of people said that that kind of lent sort of a curious vibe to the festival, although apparently that was far... There was far less of that than there was of anything else. I talked to Mitch Ryder, and he said something to me I love... I remember I was interviewing Mitch Ryder for a story about Goose Lake, and the first thing he said to me was, "I remember very little about Goose Lake because I was tripping on acid the whole time." He said, "Nobody was straight. It wasn't cool to be straight. There were straight people there, obviously, or couldn't have been pulled off, but there weren't very many." Now, you have all these people, and the cops were smart enough not to go into the grounds at Goose Lake because they knew that if they did, it would probably cause problems. However, they were waiting outside, and it's said that somewhere in the neighborhood, about 160 people were arrested by the police as they were leaving for possession, even though Teagarden and Van Winkle, who were the MCs for the event, they were urging everybody to burn their stash before they left. I just want to say about the couple that was in the previous slide. Yeah, I included this just because A, they were leaving, and B, I have never seen two people that look more like they walked right out of a Daniel Klaus cartoon. I mean, Daniel Klaus dreams of people like that. Anyway, eventually after the fallout from the festival came very shortly afterwards. William Milliken, who some of you may remember was the governor of Michigan at the time, he was away from Michigan during the weekend of Goose Lake. He was attending a governor's conference. However, when he came back, he issued a statement that he was outraged by the drug use at the festival and said, quote, "I do not oppose rock festivals, but I do oppose and will fight drug abuse such as took place at Goose Lake." Frank Kelly, who was then attorney general, then proposed laws that would make property owners responsible for illegal acts place on their grounds, and immediately this was used against Richard Songer. He was indicted in October of 1970 by the Jackson County Citizens Grand Jury and charged with aiding and abetting the sale of heroin and marijuana. The case eventually went to a jury trial, and he was exonerated in December of 1971. However, while this is all happening, Bruce A. Barton, who we'd mentioned before, he filed an injunction to close Goose Lake Park on the grounds that it was a nuisance to the public. Eventually, while Songer fought this in court for quite some time, in 1972 the injunction became permanent. The park was closed, and he never had another show there. The festival ended up being a major cultural event in Michigan. As I've discovered, people totally remember it, but it got extremely little press outside of the state of Michigan. And I asked Tom Wright if he had an idea why, and he said he thinks he's the reason why, because he was running the backstage and he ran a very tight ship. His idea was that musicians and their crew should be backstage and nobody else. So there were a lot of major rock magazines came to cover Goose Lake, but when they couldn't get backstage and actually talk to the musicians and told, you're going to watch outside just like everybody else, most of them didn't bother. So as a result, Rolling Stone never did a piece about this. Crawdaddy never did a piece about it. Cream did one, but on the other hand, Cream was based in Michigan. They were the only major rock magazine to cover it. So as a consequence, despite the fact that it was this enormous event, it really never made much press nationwide. But it is very well remembered amongst people in Michigan. It was one of the major cultural, it was one of the last really great countercultural events that took place here. And for sheer numbers, the only festival that really matched it was the Detroit Electronic Festival of the last few years. Again, I like something the Mitch Ryder said about it. He said, it was a clash of cultures for sure, but that's how change comes about. And I'm proud to say I was part of that. So that's it. And this was the program for Goose Lake that it was done in the form of an underground comic, and it was done by the late, great Mr. Gary Grimshaw, so who just recently passed. So that's everything pretty much I had planned on saying about